I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everybody. Today, my guest is Dr. Jennifer Mueller. Her expertise is in social psychology, and she is on the faculty of the University of San Diego. She's also the author of a book called Creative Change, Why We Resist It and How We Can Embrace It. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for being my guest today.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you for having me.
So I should also mention that you've taught at some of the top business schools as well, Wharton and the Yale Business School. What are some of the other places where you've taught?
Oh boy, NYU. I've taught at New York University. I've been very fortunate to have been really shaped and honed by these places where a lot of these ideas started to take shape and then decided to live my dream of living near the ocean.
Ah, that sounds good, especially now it's 10 degrees here. So,
Yeah.
So I was hoping to really dig into understanding some of the roadblocks that we have trouble with solving problems in group settings, whether it's family settings or jobs or projects we work on in groups or church groups or community groups. And we sometimes will run into these roadblocks of never really innovatively solving problems or creatively solving them. We'll kind of go back and have the same similar solutions. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your major influences and some of your background and why you got into this field of study.
I used to study marriage and health. And what I didn't realize in my early 20s was studying marriage and health was a horrible way to find a guy. Because if you mention that on your date, the date gets much shorter than you might imagine it should be. And so I thought to myself, there were other factors, but one of the things that happened was I was looking for a job for summer because I was a PhD student making no money. And, you know, I was at Brandeis University and they said, hey, Jen, there's this job over at Harvard Business School working with Teresa Amabile. She used to work at Brandeis. And so I interviewed with Teresa. She hired me and never was able to get rid of me. So I worked with her for, I think it was 5 years in her laboratory. And Teresa is really the mother of creativity, the research that we know of creativity. And I started to become fascinated with this, and not only because of all the reasons why we love creativity, because it brings so much joy to our life, but also the dark side of it. And the dark side, in my view, was how much pain people had when they tried to share their ideas and how odd it was. Because when you asked people, do you love creativity or are you biased against it, you yourself, people would say, of course I'm not. Mm. I love creativity. It's other people. Other people are the problem. Mm. My ideas are getting rejected because of other people. And when I started down the road of asking these questions, all of a sudden I got very odd responses from people about this very question. So my first job at Wharton, I remember being really nervous about getting tenure. And so I asked people, how do you get tenure? And they said, you need a breakthrough paper, a home run. And I said, oh, okay. So what does a home run mean? And they said, oh, you got to publish something early when you first begin. It's got to have a lot of citations. It's got to be published in a really good journal. And I said, oh, what about creativity? And they'd look at me strangely and they'd say, I don't know. It doesn't really need to be creative. And I thought, what? Isn't that the whole point? Isn't that what science is supposed to do? Is supposed to break paradigms? Isn't that why something is cited? And so I'd get responses like that, not only from within places that are supposed to love creativity, but also within businesses, within medical communities. It's the same kind of doublespeak where, yeah, creativity is great until all of a sudden, you know, money is on the line, reputation is on the line. And then all of a sudden people back off and they'll say, no, the solution has to work. It has to be a great idea. You know, creativity is all well and good, but it's really got to solve the problem. And that's when I started to realize, oh my gosh, the problem is people have this myth that you can know if a creative idea is good. They can, that creative ideas are knowable. Like an expert can look at all the ideas, let's say 2,000 of them, and pick out the very best and know that's going to appeal to consumers. And that's just not true. So that's where I started to realize that how people feel when they're confronted with an impossible goal in our lives in any kind of circumstance, and how we feel is terrified. Experts in all contexts and students even are being trained to think that creative ideas, the quality of them is knowable, and to assume that's true. So they're going to be accountable for whatever they choose as being actually good.
Your book mentions something about even at the most innovative creative companies where they seem to they express in extreme ways, we want new ideas, that people are hiding their creative work until they've proven that their idea works, that actually those environments are actually hostile to the creative ideas suggested.
Yeah, and they're in Silicon Valley. Those examples were in Silicon Valley. So it's not about being supportive or not supportive of creativity in the environment. At least that's what the initial work is showing. It's that the very way we train leaders to recognize creative ideas, when you put somebody in a role where they have to allocate resources, they've been trained in all their classes and in all of their engagements with other business people or other people in their communities to want accuracy and correctness. They want to choose correct decisions. Mm-hmm. And if you're on some type of committee, and let's say you're going to spend money that your church has been saving, and if you spend that money, you're going to be accountable if that solution fails. You don't want to make a mistake. You know, it's really important you get it right. And the problem is, with creative ideas, rarely out of the gate are they right the first time. You got to tweak them. It's a process. You know, something goes wrong here, and so you have to tweak this. And if you don't have that flexibility, which many organizations don't realize they need, then all of a sudden they try to implement the creative ideas like it's the end-all be-all. They see that it fails, and they don't know what to do, and then they start saying, creativity sucks. Who wants it? Creativity is just a different kind of animal, and we've been treating creative ideas just like they're like familiar ideas. And I think that's where a lot of the problem and the major insight from the book is that change is different than creative change.
And so in a way, you have to kind of be inoculated against that fear of all that risk that comes with something very innovative and new, a new idea, because it comes with a lot of risk attached to it because it's untried.
Yeah, you know, I think of it as one, if you think of it as inoculated against, in some ways, denying that fear and anxiety, because that anxiety is actually can be helpful because it can focus you on finding the things you need to pay attention to tweak the idea later. It's also seeing the hope. So where the work has gone is to say that when things are unknowable and you treat them like they're knowable, you're just not going to like them. You're going to be like, look, this isn't correct. Nobody's using it. Or they did use it. And look, it didn't work here or it didn't work there. This isn't that great. Look at this other thing that everybody else is using. It must be great. It's that kind of thinking versus if you approach a creative idea like, okay, I know it's not going to be perfect. I can't know the answer, but that's okay. I'm going to take a deep breath and I'm going to look to see, okay, let's implement this on a small scale, see how it works, see, you know, where the problems are, then we'll kind of increase the number of people who get to see it or use it. And then all of a sudden now we'll launch it. It's that kind of a mindset. So it's not so much inoculation as it's thinking like an inventor, but in the course of making decisions.
So in a real life example, say you're working for a nonprofit and you have a new idea, and instead of rolling out this big campaign, this big launch, you do a little pilot and you think people would be less resistant to accept a new idea if it's done in a curtailed way or something like that.
Possibly. And part of what helps that, so say you're in a group. You're in a group and you're in the nonprofit and you presented this idea to the group. The way the group treats the uncertainty that comes with the idea is key to whether or not that group will say yes to something new. So many groups that I see and that I study, when they first see an idea, they immediately go to, is this feasible? Do we have the money? Do we have the resources available? How many people would it take? They go into the how of the idea. And then they compare it to other ideas and they say, okay, which one's the best? And as soon as they do this, they've lost their ability to find value in the new. They're just not going to choose the new idea because you can't know if it's best and you don't know how to implement it. And we find that groups that take that how best approach to problem solving choose ideas faster and make poorer decisions. But groups who start off with a little bit of the how, which is the best, but then move to this why. So why are we doing this again? Mm-hmm. What's the problem we're trying to solve? Well, let's look at the potential here. And there seems to be this dialectic that happens in groups. Now, this is a paper that I'm working on with a colleague of mine, Sarah Harvey, from University College London. So it isn't out yet. It's very new. And it isn't yet in the book because it was so new at the time I was writing the book. But what we found was that if you can start the process off with a little bit of how, but immediately come in with a why kind of perspective, meaning the broader goal, end state in mind, and keep that cycling forward. So you're not just talking about all the possibilities and why it's great and your goals. You're not just talking about how to implement it. You're talking about both. And it seems to be that dynamic and dialectic that helps groups ultimately find value in the new and see a pathway forward with the new.
That's a really interesting and insightful point, because as you continue to keep in mind your end goal and solving the problem, you don't put yourself into a dead end of was this tried, who else has tried it, where has it succeeded, and you're cutting yourself off to potential lateral thinking, new ideas and untried things, but you've already kind of short-circuited all those potential opportunities because you've already determined your roads. They're way shorter than the other ones. And that's a really interesting point. But if you bring back in what's the problem we're solving again and again, you're bringing that question back in, then you won't be as short-sighted.
Well, we think so. We think that it's this... That how things get implemented and the resources you have are important, but also the goal you're trying to achieve. And sort of this recognition that there are multiple kinds of solutions, they're not just one solution. This recognition that maybe the status quo hasn't worked so well, or there's some uncertainty about whether or not the solution other places are using would be good for your institution. So there's this discussion, there's this word which really upsets me. It's this term that people use called best practices. Have you heard this term?
Yeah.
It's a best practice. When I hear that, I bristle and I think, what does that even mean? Does that mean we should never change? Does that mean that if this place is doing something that we should? I mean, it's such a strange term. And I think in part it's contributing to the status quo bias, people just continuing to do what they've always been doing. And so the other thing that's important, or at least I found in my work, is that in many groups, let's say in this, going back to this nonprofit example, and the nonprofit has a problem they need to solve, and so they generate some ideas and they choose which way to go. What I often find is that really creative ideas are in the set of ideas that these groups consider. It's not that they're having trouble generating the possible solutions. It's that they're having trouble on the selection end of figuring out which one they want to pursue. That's where I'm finding the major roadblock in groups, because groups want to conform and all the reasons that we already know about group biases.
Now, in the book, I was tempted that we role play all the different parts and use a female and male voices and everything on page, which page, and then I thought maybe that's really asking a lot out of our listeners. So, but it's on page 177, and you lay out a kind of a group discussion here and the different people and what a typical meeting might look like in a group and what the different people want and who added creativity to the group and what different people were hoping to get done. Somebody wants efficiency, somebody wants feasibility, and you lay that all out. And then in the end, there's a person who is asking questions. It doesn't really, in a sense, contribute to any answers, but is also the only person in the group who is could possibly come up with a solution that no one has tried or even thought of or is even willing to kind of go in a different direction or consider a different direction. And that's probably where a group could find something innovative. And maybe you can explain, I don't know if you have your book in front of you or not, but maybe you can explain a little bit of that scenario and how it works in a practical sense and what people can do to make their group meetings more, I guess, more vital and more, not just efficient, but I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, not go the same old way and stick with the status quo, but really be innovative and productive in the best ways possible.
Sure. Just to preface the part of the book, in case listeners who I hope will read the book, see this part of the chapter. This chapter is really about how do you recognize creative potential in leaders. And one of the things that my research has uncovered is this difficulty people have when they see someone generating a creative idea to then assume that person also has leadership potential. And in fact, we show that when people generate creative ideas, they're seen as having less leadership potential. And later work of mine is starting to find out that we think when people generate ideas that they are unfocused and they're not as efficient. And there's something about generating ideas that creates this belief that runs contrary to leadership. But in the context of a group, the vignette was really meant to say, okay, who's the leader in the group and go through that. Now, in my own, this example comes from an actual team. And what we found was that groups can be really inefficient when they're trying to make decisions. And there are two big reasons that I outline why that's true. The first is the conformity problem. When you're brainstorming something and everybody starts giving the same kind of idea. The example in the book is a brainstorming exercise I sometimes use with executives and students. And it's to try to come up with a new kind of way to clean dog excrement. It's gross, right? But it's funny and people laugh. And so you have people start to generate ideas about how to do this. And sometimes you'll get a group and they talk about bags that won't break, bags that don't smell, bags that you can carry with you easily. You know, so all kinds of different kinds of bags. And that's one version of conformity. You know, you're all talking about a similar kind of idea, as opposed to an idea where you, I don't know, make the excrement disappear with a spray, or you you have a robot coming and picking up the whatever. So that's a version of conformity, and leaders who know to look for that and to say, hey, I'm noticing everybody's doing the same thing. You know, what about thinking about something else? Another kind of a busy mom, or what about thinking about a government official who's looking at this? How would that person view the problem? And so being in that context, leading the group with, let's say, a self-concept of another kind of person trying to solve the problem, to get them out of their being anchored on the same kind of solution. So that's one thing that you can do in a group in the context of brainstorming. In the context of selecting which idea to pursue, sometimes what you'll see is groups start to discuss stuff, and groups loved and are very good at evaluating things. But one of the problems you see in groups is that they tend to polarize in one direction or another. You can only imagine, at least in my head, I imagine when I think about why was it that the Republicans, when they first met, decided that they wanted to dismantle this ethics committee. Like, what was it that led to that? What were they thinking? And one possibility, and I don't know that this is true, but one possibility is they could have polarized and shifted towards more kind of risk or less kind of risk, more conservative or more risky. And you see groups do that. So people are kind of aligned in one direction or another, and they each kind of, you know, they, one person says, yeah, you know, this is a bad idea. Another person chimes in and says, this is the worst idea I've ever heard. Another person chimes in and says, in fact, this idea is so bad that let me tell you how bad I think this idea is. And all of a sudden, there's this momentum around this. And the group feels like it agrees. And a lot of it is kind of status people just vying for status in the group, try to be the one who's heard and who moves the decision forward. Mm-hmm. But you can polarize it towards making a really risky decision that doesn't really make any sense. So groups can do that, and we see that. And so one way, perhaps, to counter that, it's very difficult to counter that. Mm. One way to counter that is to start, and we need to test this in the laboratory. This has not yet been tested in the laboratory. This is an idea for a very good, bright young PhD student to test. But we think theoretically this should be true, is asking questions. Mm. Why would this be true? You know, mm-hmm. where would this get us? And you know, it might not be enough to break the polarization, especially when it gets to that extreme level. Mm-hmm. But being aware of polarization and starting to ask questions to move the group away from polarizing in one direction mm-hmm. is one kind of a non-confrontational way that you can help lead the group towards thinking differently.
Hmm. Yeah, you're right. There's also such an emotional... people don't even realize how emotional they're getting. And what used to be the center, once you get so polarized on the one side, the center isn't the center anymore. And
yes,
you know, and then you're thinking, wow, I'm going to be way right or left of center, and I'll look like the crazy person who's center, but I'm not going to be center anymore because it got so polarized. And then I'll look like I'm betraying the whole group, even though I'm trying to be just put in a smidgen of reason in there. You know, when you were talking about group conformity, I was thinking that you were talking more about the emotional group conformity. And it seems like you were talking about that a little bit, but in terms of when bandwagoning happens, mm-hmm. and you get a few people who are like very enthusiastic about something, and then to raise a few questions, you look like you're popping everybody's balloon, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all you're doing is really saying, well, what about this or what about that? And you look like you're, oh, thanks for putting a nice wet blanket on our fire here.
It's really true. And that's why I say, you know, I mean, when I looked at this happening in an actual group, there were many other circumstances that allowed this person to ask questions effectively, and which I didn't go into in the course of the example, because the example was really, you know, who's the leader? And try to pick out who's the leader. But one of the things that becomes really tough in a group is, in some ways, you're not just having a discussion about the best idea. You're also maintaining your reputation, mm-hmm. your relationships with others, deciding, you know, do I really want to fight this battle? Mm-hmm. You know, is this really worth it to me? And when it comes to innovation and creativity, most of what I'm seeing happens immediately at the beginning of the meeting. If once you've polarized to that point, it's very hard to bring the group back, like you've just said, for all mm-hmm. the reasons that you just said. You almost have to, that's why the dialectic of going back and forth, mm-hmm. You know, immediately, as opposed to letting people think the same way and progress in that way, like focusing on all the reasons why this isn't feasible and all the reasons why it's so costly, mm. you've just lost the group. Mm-hmm. And in that case, oftentimes what I'll say is, you know what, you're not going to be able to choose a new idea in that context. Mm. There isn't going to be room for it. One possibility is you reschedule the meeting. Mm-hmm. Another possibility is, if you feel like you're going to break momentum, is to have a break. Mm. You know, and try to restart the meeting with more of this dialectic. Mm-hmm. But if you really, and some people don't want novelty, they just don't. Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly fine. You don't always need new ideas. Mm-hmm. The question is, do you need a new idea? And that in and of itself can be a really important discussion.
Well, I'm wondering too, how much can be said then for setting the table in a sense? So when people come into the meeting, you're saying, we're going to be presenting ideas, and then we're going to be asking questions about those ideas, and those questions aren't supposed to be threatening. And they're not meant to be threatening. They're meant to get to the best solution. I mean, is there something to be said for just leadership about how we run a meeting kind of thing?
Oh, for sure. I love the idea of setting the table. I think it's a wonderful analogy. And we do see that sometimes when leaders introduce a topic, they'll introduce it with a dialectic. Mm. They'll say things like, we want to be efficient, we want to be within our budget mm-hmm. and our timeline, But we also have a big problem to solve, and it's looking like the solution we have and have been using has all kinds of problems for all kinds of reasons. And when you have, you start off with that kind of a dialectic, sometimes the groups, at least I think in 40% of the cases that we had in our sample, the groups follow suit.
I've heard two different answers to this, so I'm interested in your answer. Would you say that it's better to present the problem to people individually, to have them chew on it and present their problems, or do you think it's, I mean, present their solutions, or do you think it's better to bring a solution up to a group and have them hash it out and brainstorm right there for new solutions?
Oh, depends, I suppose, on what your goal is. When I study creativity, one of the reasons why I started to study and become really interested in it, the underlying reason, is I think there's all this focus on making correct and accurate decisions, but how do you get people to change their minds? Like, where do we learn that in school? Where? You will learn how to teach how to think the teacher thinks. You learn, you know, how to take tests, but how do you learn how to turn off a thought maybe that isn't counterproductive or is wrong and switch to a new one systematically? And that's just, so these paradigm shifts, we just don't know much about how to do them. So your initial question was, wait, say it again so I can remember my frame of thought. It did connect, I swear.
Right. So if you're trying to come up with an innovative solution to a problem, instead of bringing up the problem first to a group and having them brainstorm and hash it out and ask questions, is that the better strategy, or is it better to give everybody the problem to chew on and then come present a solution and then hash it out and ask questions and all that?
Thank you. So where I'm going with that is, if you are attempting to just generate something new from what you had before, let's say you have a starting solution and you want people to generate on it. What we know is that when you have people look at it individually and start making their own notes and generating, that they're more likely to come up with something that's not anchored by the group. So they're going to come up with something different from other members. If they're in the group, they're going to contaminate each other. The first person who speaks will anchor everybody else to think more similarly to that person. It's just how groups kind of work. If you are attempting to push through an idea, so you're not so much interested in generating a lot of ideas as much as you are pushing through a solution you think will really work, the same kind of process can be helpful in the sense of what I call a feedback pitch. So a feedback pitch is when you're getting quote unquote feedback, but what you really want to do is influence the person to say yes to your idea. So the way you give a feedback pitch is you say, you know, here's my idea. What do you think? And when you say, what do you think? What you're really looking to find out is how the person is currently thinking about the problem. What are the objections the person has? What are the concerns the person has? And once you know what those are, sometimes all it takes are really minor tweaks to the idea, or sometimes all it is that person just wants to feel like the idea isn't so weird and unfamiliar. So if you make a simple change in the phrasing, it's enough for them because now they kind of own the idea too. And they can feel much more comfortable with it than if they see it for the first time in the meeting. And that can take a lot of work. So if you have let's say a meeting with six people and you have an idea you really want to push through, doing that feedback pitch ahead of time with each person, getting their feedback and then writing them back and saying, hey, you know what? I changed this. Thank you so much. Assuming, of course, you did make the change and that you agree that it, facilitated or made the idea better. And then all of a sudden now the group, each member kind of feels a little bit more ownership towards that idea. And the idea is less unfamiliar and there's more initial buy-in. And when they see that idea in the meeting, they're more aligned than they otherwise would be if they just see the idea for the first time. We are very complicated when it comes to unknowability. Like it fuels romantic passion. When you talk mm-hmm. about unknowability, it's something, it's almost a basis for religion. Mm-hmm. It's how we make sense of the world around us. And sometimes we have this wonderful hope, mm-hmm. but we can also have horrifying fear. You know? Yeah. So we kind of have both.
Yeah, it's love-hate relationship.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, maybe you can talk about, on page 185, the three questions leaders can ask when we're trying to solve problems. I thought those were really helpful. If we're trying to get through a problem, to get to a solution, and this will really help us hone in and get there instead of kind of languishing and I mean, there's nothing worse than being in a meeting and finding out there's all these conflicting interests and all this like trouble to wade through before you're going to ever get somewhere. And I think these are really helpful questions.
So so one of the things that I've noticed when I talk to leaders, and when I have reviewed the literature and the way scholars think about creativity and leadership, is I think scholars think about creativity and leadership as leaders encourage other people to generate ideas. And when leaders actually think about creativity and leadership, they think about making change in the organization. And so there seems to be this disconnect. And so what I tried to do was help people identify who a creative leader might be. Somebody who can actually make change in the course. And one way you can do that is by continuing to ask questions, because questions can allow underlying assumptions to emerge, can do all kinds of things and help increase curiosity. So questions have all these wonderful benefits. So the three questions, the first is, what problem are we trying to solve? Where I find this question is really important is, for some reason, when executives get together in a room, they all want to make a decision. And they think that's the goal. And further, they think that the problem they're trying to solve is usually really simple. It's about profitability. It's about, we just want to make a good decision. They'll say things like that. But what does profitability mean to each member? What does good decision mean to each member? Is it the same thing? What if it's different? How do you know if it's different? And a leader who's savvy will know to look for those underlying differences, because they can be a source of conflict, miscommunication, and getting people aligned on what's the problem we're actually trying to solve can be a really helpful way to go about then proceeding forward, as opposed to just talking about the solutions themselves. So what problem are we trying to solve? And this is a question that you might actually bring into the conversation again and again, because it might come to pass that people think that they know the answer, and then all of a sudden a lot more emerges through the conversation. And so oftentimes I see leaders who do well bring it in again in the event that there's some uncertainty. The second is, why does a solution have value? So the idea of value is supposed to get people away from thinking about just feasibility or just cost and focus on other people, the customer or the person who is a member of your church or your community. Because it's interesting, when you're making that decision, you might really care about the money and the efficiency, but the person who's going to be using the product doesn't care about how efficient you are necessarily, or how much money it's going to take you to implement something. They just want their problem solved. So it's almost, in a way, perspective taking about what value might mean more broadly, as opposed to, you know, in the immediate situation. And then, how can we make the solution work? And that's really kind of a brainstorming question. So sometimes people will say, this isn't feasible, this isn't cost effective. And so they'll say, okay, let's move on. This solution isn't good. As opposed to saying, okay, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. How can we make this? Is there a way to make this solution work? How can we make it work? Because sometimes creative ideas, they do, and they need tweaks. They're not perfect. They look weird. And, you know, sometimes you have to get people to feel comfortable with, you know, trying at least to cover most of the bases before you try it out.
Well, the one about value is so good, is so important. There are so many companies that have made a wrong turn and like solve the wrong problem. You know, they're trying to do the one thing, and then people get upset or mad or no, it didn't work. It was like they kind of forgot who they were working for in a way. And that's kind of where it's easy to lose focus, especially as you get to be a bigger organization, maybe. So that's the value is really, I think that's really, really key, because you can wind up just solving the wrong problem.
Yeah.
Depending on the stakes, like if people in the meeting are trying to be like, it's about the budget, it's about making this meeting 15 minutes long instead of 45 minutes long, you know, you can completely forget, like, okay, we're, you know, this is a homeless shelter and we actually have to make people comfortable and safe, and, you know, might wind up completely solving a different sort of thing. So, yeah, I appreciate that, because it's easy to lose focus and you're not even realizing you're losing focus until it's too late.
And that's why having leadership, in my view, is not about knowing the answers. Because when it comes to creativity, if you say you know the answers, you're faking it. Because no one can know. Or you're a psychic or a prophet, you know.
Well, yeah.
You might be a prophet. I don't know. No judgment. But because you just don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. And the problem there, of course, is that we think when someone says they do know the answer, we think, oh, they must be a good leader. And they make us feel like, oh, you know, they're confident, so they make me feel safer. Mm. But that isn't real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's real when people are trying to innovate is when they're asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And when they get the group to start considering and thinking about and discussing and having the dialogue about things that they hadn't considered before.
Mm. Yeah, that what scares me most is leaders who are so confident they act like they've done it all before, and instead of acting like, hey, we're trying this out, because it gives you the sense that it is fake. Like, how could you possibly know what's going to happen? You couldn't possibly know what's going to happen. But if you were saying, well, you know, I've had some experience, but we've never been here before, but let's see what happens. And no, I don't know what's going to happen next, but we're going to try this and see. And, you know, it's that kind of humility that gives me more confidence in my leader, not them knowing all the answers. Like you were saying, there's that part in the book where you're talking about spotting a fake. And maybe you can go into that a little bit, because that's the thing that can really throw people off. They'll have confidence in the wrong kind of leader, because they'll feel secure that someone knows the answers, but it's easy to fake people for a while.
Yeah, it's very odd. When I ask students to do an exercise and get feedback from, you know, an employer, for example, oftentimes the feedback will be, you should have more confidence.
Hmm.
You should have more confidence. We're kind of obsessed with confidence.
Hmm.
And I mean, I can understand confidence could mean that you do speak up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, confidence could mean that people now pay attention to what you're saying. And so confidence can in and of itself be a good thing. But, you know, there's a sense at which we rely so much on confidence as this key indicator of leadership, mm-hmm. and to make us think a person is strong, to make us think a person is competent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's sort of like learning about the kind of confidence we need. Not that you should throw confidence out with the bathwater, not that confidence is bad or confidence is good. It's that some kinds of confidence is great. And some kind of confidence isn't necessarily realistic.
Mm-hmm.
So some kind of confidence, and leaders know this. Leaders know when they're trying to rise up through the hierarchy, when they're trying to get press, when they're trying to be respected. They know what plays really well is saying, I know all the answers. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It makes people feel safe. At the same time, you know, when they're actually in the room solving the problem, that exact kind of a behavior, that exact kind of language shuts down subordinates thinking.
Mm.
You know, they're like, oh, you know the answers. You know? Mm-hmm. You have the answers. So there's no reason for us to have a dialogue. Just tell us what to do.
Mm.
And of course, the leader doesn't necessarily have the answer and, you know, needs some experimentation, because that's what creativity involves. And so needs to not know. And it's just that kind of a recognition that when you want a leader that really understands how to lead for change and potentially creativity, there's a complexity there. You want some amount of confidence, but the kind of confidence you want is the confidence to ask questions, because that's actually, as you noted before, can be a really risky behavior. To say you don't know and to ask questions, much more risky than saying you do know in a short term.
Well, this has been good. It's probably a good place to stop. But for anybody who wants to dig in more into your book and find out where you are and your work, can you give them that information?
Sure. Please come and visit my website. It's jennifersmuller.com. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm just starting up my Twitter. Twitter is a little scary these days, so I'm gonna, you know, if you follow me on Twitter, it'll give me more bravery to then start to tweet. My Twitter handle is Jen S. Mueller, JennSMueller. And in general, I try to update my website with stories about how people overcome creative opportunities. So please feel free to share your stories with me. I'd love to hear them. And I'd love to continue the dialogue about how to help people change their mind and how to bring more creative change into our lives.
If you've listened to the show, but you'd like more information about someone mentioned or a book, or a website, all that can be found in the detailed show notes I create for every show. A link to those show notes can be found at sparkmymuse.com for this episode, or you can find them directly at the support page at patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E, patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Show notes cost $1 and include all show notes for an entire month. Thank you so much for making Spark My Muse possible.